This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
Welcome back. I'm Laura Flanders sitting in for Tom. Hey, Tom. Howdy. Oh, they don't say howdy on the high seas. I don't know. Bottoms up, you don't say that either. What do you say on the high seas? Do you talk about port and starboard? Do you say, cheerio, mate? I don't know. Anyway, hi. Hope it's going well. Tom is out there. Tom and Louise are out there floating. I hope they're enjoying themselves. I've been on those cruises. The trouble is, all the guests, they want to talk about politics all the time. 866-303-2270. 866-303-2270. That's the number to call. I'm Laura Flanders. You can hear me usually on Radio Nation here on Air America Radio Weekends. What fun it is always to sit in for Tom. Why? Because you are all so smart. All right, smarty pants out there, here's what I want to talk about today. Joanne Wypijewski, a friend of mine who writes for The Nation magazine and Harper's, among others, just came back from Ohio. She writes a letter from Ohio, actually postcards from various towns in Ohio, for the cover of the new Nation magazine, the one that goes to press today. So don't feel bad if you haven't seen it yet. She writes that in town after town after town, she goes to Canton, she goes to Lordstown, she goes to Columbus, Springfield, Youngstown, you name it. In town after town, there is a sense of desperation. These are places, as she writes of Youngstown, to which a bridge to the 21st century was never built. These are places where the jobs left in the 80s, NAFTA was the icing on the cake. These are places where the white working class simply sees no future, where there's no young, new immigrant population taking root. There are migrants, but there isn't the kind of renewal that's coming in some places with the growth of immigrant culture. These are places where it comes as no news to them, although it seems to come as news to the New York Times today, that neither of the Democratic contenders has ever been much of a foe of fair trade, which is to say rigged trade, as far as I'm concerned. Neither one of them has been a big advocate of fair trade, the trade that didn't screw the smallest family farm and smallest personal small business in order to benefit and profit the richest agribusiness and global corporation. Neither Barack Obama nor Hillary Clinton, for everything they've said in the last couple of weeks, has ever been much of a campaigner against NAFTA or against that kind of trade policy that I've just described. They say that all those kinds of policies are worthy of a review today, but the New York Times writes a headline this morning, "Neither one has been a foe of fair trade. It comes as no news to the people of Ohio." So Joanne travels around these various parts of Ohio, the Southwest, the Northeast, you name it, and she finds people who are desperate for some kind of hope, desperate for some kind of a future. And she makes the following suggestion. She suggests that in the same way that voters, for example, in Kansas or other parts of the country, the voters that Thomas Frank has written about, will vote for Republicans on issues of abortion and homosexuality and marriage and religion, because none of their candidates are running on the really important stuff having to do with their jobs and their schools and their roads. In the same way that the right has benefited in the past from that kind of migration, that kind of transmutation. Well, they're not talking about anything I really care about, so I'll vote on these other things. Maybe the Democrats have their equivalent today. Maybe Clinton and Obama, whose plans, let's face it, I don't think are going to really, nuts and bolts, change the day-to-day lives of people in Ohio. Maybe they're benefiting from a willingness among the voters to vote on things like gender and race and hope and energy and that overly used word, change. If gender and race and hope and energy are kind of the Democrats' equivalent of religion and abortion and marriage on the extreme right side, what does that mean for this race? And what does that mean for the kind of organizing that we can do henceforth? Is it possible to look at the model of the right and see lessons that we can learn? And are there cautionary tales in all of this? I mean, let's face it, what the right has done for years is to stir up their ground troops by promising they'll ban abortion and they'll send gays back and immigrants back, and I don't know what else they're going to do, but they stir people up with the belief that they're going to get that sort of totemic issue resolved that they care about. We will once again ban gay marriage, even though we've done it 10 times before. This time we really will reverse Roe v. Wade, even though we've never done it until now. And sure enough, those voters will churn out to the polls. They'll walk down to the polling places, and heck, no one's talking about the really important stuff, so they'll vote on those things. And I mean, no one's really talking about it on the right or the left. By the time it gets to presidential politics, most of what really counts gets stripped out. So they voted for those things, and then come election day, or rather come the day after election day, come the following January when administrations are being put together and governments are being formed, they mostly don't get most of what they were promised. Even though the right, I would say, has done a far better job, Republicans have done a far better job of catering to their base and fulfilling their promises than Democrats tend to do to theirs. But in the end, I mean, look at the state of the right today. After years of being fed these kind of decoy issues, you have a divided movement, you have a frustrated population, and I think we're going to see the lowest turnout on the Republican side that we've seen in years. I don't think Iraq can be that kind of a decoy issue. I'm not sure that terrorism really can today. But on the Democratic side, isn't it also a tripwire? Isn't it also possibly a trap to be mobilizing people around racial equality and gender equality and hope and energy and change? If there's no evidence from your actual platform that you have the capacity to actually make a difference on any of those things. Or maybe you're seeing things differently. I'm seeing both candidates now talk about, well, we're going to review trade pacts. But Hillary Clinton, I think, has passed every trade pact that's come before her, every so-called free trade pact, except for two, the most well-known ones. I think Barack Obama's done basically the same. What's actually going to make life better for the people of Youngstown? For the people of Springfield? Where, according to Joanne's reporting, there were 79,000 foreclosures in Ohio this last year. And the list of jobs, of factories, of businesses that have been lost from Springfield reads as follows. Specco Aerospace, gone. Specco Aerospace, gone. Buffalo Road Roller, gone. Bomag Earth Movers, gone. White Motors, gone. Boise Cascade, gone. O'Cedar, gone. O.S. Kelly, gone. The Foundries, gone. Robinson Myers, gone. This happened in the 80s. Manufacturing began moving to the non-union South in the 80s. In the 90s, NAFTA ensured it would never come back. Corporate America, says one of the people quoted in Joanne's story, corporate America, you give them an inch, they take a mile, and in this case, they've taken our lives. What does either of the Democratic candidates now running for president promise when it comes to the lives of the people of Ohio? I want people to weigh in. Am I too down this morning? Am I too down today? Is there real change in the offing, and what will make that real change? I suggest it's not the candidates, it's the campaigns, it's not even the presidential campaigns, it's the issue-based campaigns and the movements that we will build to push these candidates, all of them. Because let's face it, at the end of the day, we remain outside the White House, no matter who gets elected in. We remain outside. Our job is to push. Our job is to push from here. 866-303-2270, 866-303-AAR0. That's the number to call. On today's show, we're going to hear from Bob Fitrakis in Columbus. He teaches at the State Community College. He is one of the forces behind the Free Press, published independently since 1992. One of the big people blowing the whistle on election shenanigans in 2004. Bob Fitrakis will be our first guest in this hour. We'll also go to Texas, and then we'll hear about losing Iraq. I'm Laura Flanders. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
I'm not embarrassed to tell you that I did not watch the Democrat debate last night, but I am told that Senator Obama made the statement that if Al-Qaeda came back to Iraq after he withdraws, after the American troops are withdrawn, then he would send military troops back if Al-Qaeda established a base in Iraq. I have some news. Al-Qaeda is in Iraq. Al-Qaeda, it's called Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
I have some news for John McCain, and that is that there was no such thing as Al-Qaeda in Iraq until George Bush and John McCain decided to invade Iraq.
There's some substance for you, folks. Senator John McCain sounding off yesterday and responded to almost immediately by Senator Barack Obama. I'll tell you, if we are going to avoid an election of illusion, where the issues are abstractions, like do you trust the black guy? Can you really trust a woman? Better to stick with a good white man who's, after all, Christian and will ban abortion and is against gay marriage. If we want to avoid a campaign like that, we better focus on substance. And I suggest that Iraq could be the substantive issue that we lack. 866-303-2270. But unless we, in the sane world, force the candidates to make this the issue of this election, I think we're in trouble. 866-303-2270. And ahoy. That's the word I was searching for. Thank you, caller. Ahoy is what you say on the high seas. How could I forget? Let's take a quick call from Mike in Westchester. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the program. Oops, there you go, Mike. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you very much. I just wanted to say that I would hope that one or both of the Democratic candidates would have an epiphany on Ohio in the same way that John Kennedy seemed to have when he visited West Virginia when he was running for president. But I don't think we can leave it up to that. I think that we who are in the rank and file of the party, progressives, liberals, whatever we want to call ourselves, need to work very hard, not just in the primaries, but also in the convention, because, you know, we talk about the superdelegates affecting the party nominee. I think we should be more concerned about how they're going to affect the party platform.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, we can have our voice heard now during the primaries, but it's going to be about another 3 weeks, I reckon, if that, that we are really the target audience for these Democratic contenders. And that's why it's so important that on the war, on trade, on all the issues that we care about, this is the moment to push the progressive agenda, because you know what happens after the primaries. The candidates dodge to the right in their endless and ill-thought-out pursuit of those uncommitted swings, sitting-on-the-fence voters. You would think they would focus on the non-voters, alienated voters, the vast half our population that haven't been inspired to vote in the last few general elections. But no, we always see the Democrats go for those center voters, and it's always, you know, bye-bye to the progressive flanks. We don't count anymore. So you're right. The primary moment is our time in the sun, and we should be really taking advantage of this extended summer season. And then the next fight is the platform. But frankly, the last time there was a really serious platform fight was in 1980 when women outvoted Jimmy Carter on the Equal Rights Amendment. It was the last big platform fight, you know, hammered out in public on TV. What did the party do after that? They said, we're not going to have any more platform fights like that on television. That was basically it.
Well, that's something maybe we need to change. Maybe we need to really press the issue here and let people know that democracy is alive and well, that dissent is okay, but that we, at the end of the day, we all come to a consensus about what we're going to put together and how we're going to move forward.
All right. I thank you for your call, Mike. Appreciate it. Kyle in San Rafael. Hey, Kyle. Welcome.
Hi, and thanks. Laura, no, you're not too depressed, and you're not too down.
Are you going to say I'm not depressed enough?
Well, you know, let's take a step back from the 80s and look at what happened after the Vietnam War. Basically, in my view, what happened there was that the powers that be, however you want to define those powers, decided that because our middle class was too big and because it had too much time to worry about things like whether we were having illegal wars that may have been immoral and killed too many people, the decision was made to strip that middle class and make a volunteer army that was basically replenished by people who had no other economic alternative but to join to fight these types of wars. And I think that's it in a nutshell, what's happened to this country in the last 40 years. If you look at the very real issues that have taken place since Eisenhower, who was, compared to today's Republicans, a flaming progressive in a lot of areas, and Kennedy, I mean, when those two presidents, one of whom was a Republican and one of whom was a Democrat, and you look at what's happened since then, on issue after issue, real wealth in this country has been stripped.
All right, thanks, Kyle.
The money used to be real silver.
And don't believe that the answer is to return to gold. I know that you hear it a lot, but I don't think that's the answer to our economic woes. Kyle, I'm going to pick up some of your comments when we come back. Interesting testimony from General Casey yesterday, speaking of that volunteer army. He says after 6.5 years in war, we don't have the resources to properly sustain that volunteer army. So we've got more private mercenary forces in Iraq than we do have volunteers today. What does that mean? I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman, and who's going to change it?
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
We're back. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program here on Air America Radio. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom. You know, you can email me, and thank you everybody, and I do mean everybody who emailed me yesterday. You can email me flanders.laura@gmail.com. Flanders.laura@gmail.com. We're going to be talking in the program, on this program, in the next hour or two and a half to, among other people, Bob Fedrakis from Columbus. Lou DeBose is going to join us from Texas. He's the editor of the Texas Observer and the co-author of so many books with the beloved and much missed Molly Ivins. He's just been attending a Barack Obama campaign rally. I'm not quite sure where. We'll find out. I think probably somewhere around Austin, maybe. We'll see. Lou will join us at some point. And we'll also be joined in our last hour by Jonathan Steele, the British Guardian reporter, who's written a damning new book, Defeat, on why the U.S. and Britain lost Iraq and how. All of that coming up on the program, along with a whole lot more of your calls. Let's take this one from Andy in Pennsylvania. Hey, Andy, welcome to the program.
How are you doing today?
I am doing okay.
That's good. I got a quick question for you and a comment. The
All
question
right.
is this. We got two Democratic candidates, both of them support NAFTA, both of them support free trade, both of them support the corporatist agenda in this country. What in the hell is wrong with us?
Well, answer your question, Andy, because there was a candidate who talked about poverty and war, John Edwards. What happened to him?
I don't know. I think the corporations, and that's one of the reasons why I think this these primaries like they are is kind of, it's almost detrimental to do what they're doing. They should have a one-time primary. That way the government, the status quo can't control the press. I mean, look what they're doing with the press right now. No matter what you say, if you support Obama or Hillary, Obama is getting a lot of better press than Hillary. So it makes me think that they're pushing his agenda for some reason. Now, I don't care which, either way which one wins, but it is the truth.
Now, Andy, this is another one of those complicated situations where two simultaneous things are true, or two things are true simultaneously. One, we have media bias, media discrimination, and media control over our information. Two,
absolutely.
And I talked about it endlessly yesterday, we have bias and prejudice, every one of us, and 97% of all the clout positions in the media are held by men, most of them white men. I do believe Hillary's been getting a bad deal on the media, but at the same time, her campaign, well, at the same time, campaigns matter. So
right.
I believe that the choices she has made for advisors, for campaign strategy, her political choices up to this point have led her to this situation where she is vulnerable to a candidate who is mounting a grassroots effort and talking about change.
Sure, and another thing is her past.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Everything that has brought her to this point puts her in a poor position. She, vis-a-vis the Republicans, is in okay position, I guess, to say we'd rather have the Clinton years than the Republican current. But there's an awful lot of people who weren't doing well in the Clinton years. There are certainly a lot of people in Ohio who suffered after the signing of NAFTA and were already suffering before. So, you know, if there's a third candidate, somebody talking about change and newness and all the rest of it, she's in bad trouble. But the campaigns do matter, and I do want us to focus on this because I think this is your answer to the John Edwards question. Yes, there was media bias, but I do want to say, Andy, that I think his campaigning just wasn't up to snuff, and that's something people have to look at, but go ahead.
Well, I do have one other comment. I'm driving around a bunch of camps where I work, and, like, you know, individual home camps, you know, and
you're talking about trailer parks?
Yeah, like not like camps. Where people go to camp, they, you know, they hunt, they fish, they do things, enjoy the outdoors. Well, anyway, I've seen a couple of flags that are upside down.
Mm.
And one sign said, stop free trade. And I kind of, I don't know. You know, maybe that's what it's going to take for people to start doing something to change. Because what we're doing now is not working.
Well, you're absolutely right. What we're doing now is not working. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it, Andy. One more Sherwin in Seattle. Hey, Sherwin, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. I was, thinking that when Obama gets in office, and I believe he will, that will cause the country to have to reexamine the whole political spectrum. And I believe that Obama, having based his whole candidacy and platform upon change, will have to give a voice to the changes that people want. And I think also that we should, as a people, and rather than saying that there's no substance to what Obama says, I think we should tell him what we want to be said in Washington.
I agree. Let's not just sit back and tell them what, you know, and complain about what they say. Let's communicate what we want to be said, and this is our moment, and this is it, because after the primaries, that's it. Bye-bye. We'll only see the backs of the candidates while they rush to the right to pursue all those, on-the-fence voters.
Right. We need to break it down to them, the changes we want to see.
All right, Sherwin. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. You know, I think that one of the arguments that's working with me is that we need to consider these Democratic contenders from the point of view of who will do the most to help swing the Congress. And I'll lay it open to you to weigh in on that, but there are a lot of people I've seen interviewed over the last few months, and some that I've talked to myself, who believe that they think the Obama campaign will do more to help down-ticket candidates. And partly they say that because the Obama campaign has been so broadly dispersed across the states, meaning it has an embedded kind of grassroots structure different from the top-down structure of the Hillary campaign. Others say, no, it's the top-down endorsements and money that will help. I'm not sure. We know that in Maryland last month, Donna Edwards, an start outsider contesting a primary against a long-term incumbent, Al Wynn, an incumbent who had the backing of the Democratic leadership in the House. Nancy Pelosi threw him a fundraiser in December. Donna Edwards credited at least part of her victory, and here's a feminist anti-war activist who's just become the Democratic contender in a Democratic seat. She credits her victory in part to the support that she got from Obama volunteers and workers and from the candidate himself. And there are other stories of how even when the primary races were happening at a time different from the presidential primary race, as in Donna's case, the Obama team did encourage their volunteers to go out and work for those congressional candidates. I think that bodes well. I don't know as much about the Hillary picture. Maybe people want to correct me on this. But I think that if we're talking about what makes change in America, a president can set a tone, and a president can try to use the bully pulpit to win over the public, and that's critical. But it's the Congress that has to be strongly progressive to get progressive legislation passed. And it's the Congress we have to pay attention to. It's all up for grabs this year, too. And yet our media, I think Congress is about the least well-covered chamber of our government in our media. They cover the presidency. They cover the Senate. Those are big national offices. That's covered by national media. The local media will cover local legislature and the governor's office. But the Congress sometimes seems to fall into a gap in between. So there you have, to some would argue, I'm sure Tom would agree, you know, ostensibly the most democratic, most representative body of our government, the House of Representatives, gets the least amount of attention. I think those are the elections to be watching. And the influence, you know, one of the things to think about as you're thinking who to support in this primary race, I would say, would be which of these two candidates do you think will help those congressional candidates more? All right, I'm going to take a break. We'll come back. We're still looking for Bob Fitrakis, but if we don't find him now, we'll find him later. I'm Laura Flanders. 866-303-2270 is the number to call. We're ready and waiting to take your call and your comments. Stay tuned.
The truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're back! We are in the final stretch of a primary campaign, I think. Maybe I'm dreaming. Maybe I'm missing something. I think we're in the final stretch. I think when we're hearing that Harold Ickes is Hillary Clinton's point man to rustle up superdelegates, that's a sign of desperation. That's what it seems like to me. I'm telling you, her campaign has been floored, and that's a generous term, not only by the promises, you know, by the positions she's taken politically, but by the choices she's made logistically. Politicians don't just articulate political positions, they do political acts. And unfortunately, it seems to me that Hillary Clinton, it's not unfortunate, it is entirely in keeping with her record. Hillary Clinton has consistently followed a pattern of surrounding herself by Democratic old guard. People who were policy advisors back in the days of the formulation of the DLC, people who were her policy advisors throughout the Bill Clinton years, people who have supported her agenda, which since the 1970s has been to frame this third way for Democrats, a way that isn't the old Southern white-sheeted pre-civil rights era Democratic Party, but nor is it really the people's populist for people of color, for women, for labor party of the 70s and 80s. Early 80s. Her goal for years, and she makes no bones about it. If you read, I wonder how many of her supporters have actually, frankly, how many of her critics have actually read her book, her own autobiography. It's worth a read. Listen, it's a model of leadership a lot of people go for. It doesn't happen to be the one I go for, and I think it's one she's paying a price for today. But it's a model that's all about, you know, we will save the country. We who have risen to the top to do that work. She believes in an American and an idea of an American supremacy that I think is problematic, but is certainly an idea that a lot of her husband's supporters endorsed, an idea that it is the American role to go and invade countries where there are problems, whether it's Somalia or Yugoslavia, that embraces this notion of humanitarian intervention. It was easy for George Bush, W. Bush, to make that case because it was the case that Bill Clinton had made. That the United States has a special role in the world. And so special that international law doesn't really apply. You can make a case for it, and Hillary Clinton makes a very strong case for the bombing of Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Do I happen to think it's a good way of modeling global citizenship? No. But it's a model that has its endorsers, has its supporters. It's a model that I would say in style, if not in substance, the Barack Obama campaign rejects. And in fact, not in the last debate, but in the one before, he said a very interesting thing that nobody picked up on, which was that when the United States sets preconditions for meetings with global leaders, it is setting itself up as superior to the rest of the world, and that's not helpful, particularly in the current moment where the U.S. is on the outs with so much of the rest of the world. And not just because of its actions, but because of its inactions, and also because of its violations of international law, meaning it's not just people who don't like the U.S. choice to invade Iraq, but people who also really hate what they see at Guantanamo. See it as evil, along with the special extradition, extraordinary rendition practices, and the refusal to abide by the Geneva Conventions on torture. I mean, these are all things that have people furious at the United States. And we can argue about them, but I think Barack Obama was saying something noteworthy, and nobody took note of it, except for me, I think, that maybe it's time for the U.S. to review that attitude and send the message that, in fact, we are one of the nations, a member of a global community. It's ancient. It goes back to the early 1900s and the 18th century. I mean, in the 19th century, frankly. The whole doctrine of U.S., you know, the U.S. as the securer of liberties of citizens around the world. I think it is up for review. I'll respect anyone who disagrees with me. But Hillary Clinton, as I'm saying, Hillary Clinton has made political choices when it comes to the people she surrounds herself by, and they are consistent. It's consistent political choices over the years. She supported sanctions against Iraq. She supported the bombing of Yugoslavia. She supported when she voted for the president to have authority to use military force in Iraq. She didn't vote reluctantly, although she said it was a very, she says now it was the most difficult vote of her life. She voted very forthrightly. She got on the platform, on the stage of the Senate, and was the floor of the Senate, and was the only one of the Democratic senators who endorsed the Cheney-Bush contention at the time that there was a relationship between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. Not one other Democratic senator did that. I'm not even talking about the 24 who opposed the vote, but not one other senator who got up and voted for the resolution made that argument. It was an argument that was contested by the so-called intelligence community, and it was an argument that we've been shown was utterly fallacious at this point. So I'm just saying that Hillary Clinton is making choices that consistently put her on the outs with those, exactly those to whom Barack Obama is appealing, who are the people that say, enough of that, we want change. This is the moment to put flesh on the bones of whatever the heck Obama is saying, because that flesh is not there yet. But it's discouraging to me that in a pinch, what Clinton is doing again is returning to those same old advisors, Harold Ickes, and is still working the old way to power. Joanne Lipiewski, who I've been quoting from today from her cover story of The Nation that will come out this week, says it's shocking how little on-the-ground work is happening, frankly, from either camp in Ohio. Was happening as recently as a week ago. Key labor leaders yet to be approached by either candidate, either camp, for their endorsement. You would have thought the Barack Obama team would have got it by now, that it's that grassroots mobilization that's making the difference. It seems Hillary Clinton's resolved not to fight that way. Well, I'll take more of your calls after the break. 866-303-2270 is going to be the number to call. In a bit, we're going to hear from Lou DeBose. He's been covering Texas politics for 25 years. He worked as the editor of the Texas Observer and politics editor of the Austin Chronicle. He is co-author with the much, much, oh, how we miss our Molly Ivins, the co-author with Molly of two New York Times bestsellers, Shrub and Bushwhacked. We'll hear from Lou about how the campaigns are playing out in that all-important, delegate-rich state of Texas. And with any luck, we'll get to check in with Bob Fitrakis in Ohio, too. We'll also be hearing from Jonathan Steele, the Guardian's roving foreign correspondent and author, about his new book, Defeat, How the Invasion of Iraq Was Doomed from the Start. And we'll take more of your calls. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Don't be deceived! And ahoy there! Yes, that's the right phrase. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman while he's out cruising with the schmoozers on the Air America radio cruise. They're fun, those cruises, I have to say. I've been on, I think, oh gosh, four, five with The Nation magazine. I'll tell you, the most fun part is when you're late for the boat. That's the most fun part. It happened once when there was a snowstorm in New York, and I think I promised I'd tell you about this yesterday. Here's what happened. It was a snowstorm in New York. The cruise was leaving in December. We had to join the boat in the second port of call, which was Tampa. We got up early. We got in the taxis. We went to LaGuardia. We got on the plane. We got off the plane. We got into a taxi. We went as fast as we could. We had the good folks from the Cruise Authority on our cell phones reeling us in. But the very good people of, was it Tampa or was it Key West? Key West, I think. The good people of Key West have struck a deal with the cruise authorities and the cruise ships that stop by their town that they will move out of port in time for the sunset so that those huge 12-story-high cruise ships don't cast an enormous shadow over the entire town. Fair enough deal. But for us, this meant that our ship was about quarter of a mile out to sea by the time we arrived at the dock. What to do? What to do if they put us in a inflatable dinghy, rowed us out to the boat, and then here I am expecting some device that I can't imagine, but I'm assuming will be sophisticated to get us from the water's level, the water level, up six stories to the entry bay. What do they actually throw out? No magical device. A rope ladder. In our winter gear, in our cowboy boots, with our suitcases, we climbed the side of that boat. And you want to know what? I then proceeded, of course, to extol on all the issues I know a little tiny bit about and the couple that I know a little bit more about, and to weigh in on things I know nothing at all about, but generally to participate in articulate intellectual discourse with the subscribers of The Nation magazine. We talked about the war, we talked about the environment, we talked about women, we talked, you name it. What does anybody remember? None of that. All that has ever been remembered about my participation on a Nation cruise is that I climbed up the side of the boat on a rope ladder. So there you go. There are my cruising stories. No, it's very fun. I hope you're having fun out there, everybody. We're going to take a break and come back with our guest, Lou Dobbs. Lou Dobbs. Woo-hoo! Get it right. Lou Dobbs has been covering Texas politics for years. Longtime colleague and co-author with Molly Ivins of numerous books, most of them about Shrub. We'll talk with Lou. He's just come back from a Barack Obama rally. We'll get the latest. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in.
The truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
All right, let's take some calls. I'm Laura Flanders sitting in for Tom Hartman. We've got Lenore on the line in Merrick, New York. Hey, Lenore, how are you?
Well, I'm just fine, thanks.
Well, that's good.
And thank you for taking the call. I tell you, you've hit it right on the head, the nail on the head. I think that what happened actually in this country was a disgrace. It started with our letting Ronald Reagan fire thousands of people and not having any real outcry coming from a labor movement.
You're talking about the crushing of the air traffic controllers?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That was the first real tragedy that labor encountered.
Well, you know, it was a test. It was clearly a strategic test. It was kind of like Margaret Thatcher coming into power in the UK, and I remember this because I was a documentary filmmaker in those days. And the first thing she did was take on, or almost the first thing she did was take on two folks: the IRA, the inner city black populations, three folks, and the largest, most powerful union in the country that had helped to bring down her predecessor, Edward Heath of the Conservative Party. That was the union of mine workers.
Right. Well,
when you take on a union that's supposed to be powerful like that and manage to defeat it, that's huge.
That's right. And it was something that really was a shock. It was a shocking thing to see happen. But I think that that was the precursor to the end of the power of working people. And that what has happened since that time is with the institution of outsourcing work to foreign countries where labor is much cheaper, has resulted in no base for the Democratic Party.
No, you're absolutely right, Lenore. I mean, what does Gore Vidal say? He says we don't have an opposition party. We have two parties of property, and the Democratic Party does the same thing to its labor base as the right does to its religious base. It says, vote for us, we'll do this, this, and this for you. They never really do it. Now, on the right side, they get a whole lot closer to doing it, I'll tell you that. But then the party's in a fix on the Democratic side because they rely on those foot soldiers to do the work that a locally based, powerful party would do, but that hasn't been built. It's in disarray until very recently. It was really hardly existent in most parts of the country. And those labor foot soldiers are increasingly alienated. Read the stories from Ohio this week, and it's just heartbreaking. People who know in their hearts that neither one of these candidates is really going to help them, trying to figure out who to vote for, and that they're frankly voting, most likely to be voting on issues that aren't going to have that much different, make that much difference in their lives. We've just got Lou Dobbs on the line. He's joining us from Texas, where I believe he just attended a Barack Obama rally. Author, reporter, Lou Dobbs, observer of all things Texan and more. Where are we hearing? Where are you calling us from, Lou?
I am in Austin.
You're in Austin.
I've just seen the Messiah.
How was it for you, Lou?
You know, he's usually better. This was, I think, Texas has finally reached the moment of Obama fatigue. This is not predicting the election because I think he wins it. But, you know, we're like New Hampshire down here now. We can't get away from these people.
Now, who's fatigued, you or the candidate? The candidate certainly looks fatigued.
Well, I think that this was a pretty flat event. It was not a full house. It was downtown Austin. It was 9:30 in the morning. It was about a convention center hall about half full. The candidates look tired, but I think the people are tired, too, because it's pretty overwhelming down here. For the first time since Jimmy Carter ran for the presidency, we have a Democratic primary going on. And he did, Obama did, of course, discover working people, as your caller and as your previous discussion just suggested. But it was the Texas is overwhelmed. These two have spent more in the past three weeks than the other past four Democratic campaigns have spent totally on media in Texas.
Well, you can't complain. I mean, Texans have been complaining for years about being ignored in the race. Now you are finally counting. And I got into big trouble with Jim Hightower by the other week on Radio Nation saying, for once, Texas counts. And he says, Texas always counts. And, of course, he's right. But, you can't complain both ways. You're not getting enough attention. Now you're getting too much. With respect to the quality of the attention, let's move from the quantity to the quality. What are the candidates talking about? And are they getting the issues right?
Well, nothing that they haven't spoken about in their national campaigns and other places. I mean, I think your previous call was pretty interesting because suddenly NAFTA is a big deal and trade agreements are a big deal. And today, Senator Obama is talking about, workers seeing machine tools unbolted and moved away to Mexico and China, and that's last year's story, really. That's last decade story, but they're finally getting it because they're running in Ohio. Healthcare, nothing we haven't already seen. What's interesting in Texas for me is I have been writing about politics in Texas for more than 20 years. And I walk into an event, and a Democratic Party event in Austin, and I usually know, half the room. I went to an Obama campaign watch party to see who these folks were the other night, and there was not a single person that I knew, yet the place was packed. So I think the real story here is that they're actually drawing a lot of new voters.
Now, they're saying they're drawing. Is one candidate doing it more than the other?
My bet is that these people have seen the Clintons before, and my bet is that it's the Obama mania candidates. We have double the amount of early voting in the Democratic primary, according to the Secretary of State. We'll break the record set in 2.7 million voted in 1988. 3.3 to 3.4 will vote in the Democratic primary this year. So the Democratic Party, I mean, Bill Clinton, they talk about his network and Hillary's network, but, that was back in the McGovern days. It's like the Cat Ballou movie when they go get Lee Marvin out of retirement and teach him to shoot again and to look mean. I mean, most of these folks haven't had a horse, place, or show for 20 years.
It was interesting that Hillary Clinton, in that UT Austin debate a couple of weeks back, began by talking about how she had worked in the state in 1972.
Right.
And apart from being a really long time ago, the issues, I mean, those were the days when McGovern was running on getting all the troops out of Vietnam, on Equal Rights Amendment, on choice, and I think on mandatory minimum income supports for low-income people. I mean, boy, how things have changed. We're not there today. And those folks that she made friends with back then are not the player, make or break players in Texas at this moment.
They're not. Gary Morrow, who's a pivotal person in her campaign. He's a decent guy, and he was land commissioner for many years. But the last time we saw Gary, he was getting blown away by George Bush in the last gubernatorial election, in which the Democrats were hoping that he would pull 30% of the vote. So it's a different state. There are different issues. There were 22 in 72. In 90, in 90, there were 22 statewide elected offices held by Democrats. That's every one. Now there are none.
Zero.
So there's no Democratic Party here, and you know they're sort of going to the wizened old elders to say, well, what do you do at a precinct convention? How do you do this, Pop?
Now you do have a complicated process, and I hope that you can stay by through the break to explain the process. But before we move on, let me just ask you about two of the issues that have been coming up in the debates, but not coming up in a very useful way. One you've mentioned, which is trade, NAFTA, trade policy. The other is immigration, and I think what a lot of us have been waiting for is the moment at which the candidates say these are not two separate topics. Why people are coming across the border has to do with our trade policy that is driving them away from their homes. Is that a frame that the candidates are getting to yet in their discussion of with voters in Texas, where this has got to be a front burner issue?
Not here. No, I mean, you heard Hillary say, you know, NAFTA has been a big plus for Laredo. Well, it has for warehouse holders and freight forwarders in Laredo. But I don't think it's you know, for the border, it hasn't been that spectacular. There's a lot of growth on the border, but there's still a lot of low-wage jobs that grow.
Meanwhile, on that border, you have that wall going up that, according to the Washington Post's reporting, and I believe the Observer's reporting too, is going across poor people's land and then stopping short at the estates of people like Al Ray Hunt, one of the big funders of the Bush campaign.
Terrific reporting by Melissa Del Bosque at the Texas Observer, her story. It even goes to the campus of a South Texas college. The wall is an absurdity. I think it's there because Lou Dobbs put it there. It doesn't make a lot of sense if you live on the border. It's not the border is, you know, it's somewhere between San Antonio and the Rio Grande lies the border of between Texas and Mexico. It's pretty flexible and it's pretty porous to our advantage.
What are the new populations making of this election, and what difference are they making? I'm not only thinking about immigrants from other countries, but there's been a huge influx of former New Orleanians into Houston in the last few years, since Katrina and the levee breaks. What difference will that large, disproportionately black population make, do you think, in these primaries?
A big one. I think that population actually is champing at the bit to vote for Obama, and they're going to turn out for Obama. You know, they're angry about what their government didn't do for them and what it did to them, and they're settled and registered and have been registered to vote in Texas, and I think it's going to make a difference. And, you know, you talk about our delegate distribution system. The communities that turned out the highest votes in the past, the precincts, the senatorial districts, get the most delegates. And African Americans in Houston, they vote, you know, 3 to 4 times every election. And Mexican American voters are not the strongest voters. They're the state's weaker voters. And they're the holy grail of Texas politics. But they turn out in far lower numbers than black voters do. So you're going to see more delegates awarded because of a previous turnout in Houston, and you're going to see this. I think Houston is going to go in a big way for Obama.
And that's going to have big implications for the two candidates, because at least if past trends hold true, Hillary Clinton's been the most, you know, has been the one who's benefited most from the Latino vote, and of course Barack Obama has benefited most from the African American. When we come back from the break, Lou, I'm going to want you to explain the delegate distribution system, because Texas just has to be different. You just
better be a long break. I'll read.
Be different. It's a long break because you have primaries and caucuses. This is all just too confusing. Maybe you are the perfect people to talk about the differences between the two kinds of competitions and what they might mean in this race. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Here's the number, 866-303-2270. We've got a lot of people on the line, but we'll get to your calls. 866-303-2270. You can also write to me, as many of you are, at flanders.laura@gmail.com.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Joining us now to talk about the leaked results is Diebold PR spokesman Ernie Kenilworth. Mr. Kenilworth, this was
quite a mistake.
And we at Diebold would like to formally apologize to all of our shadowy puppet masters. This will not happen again. Please have mercy on us.
Do you think that people will still even vote in this election?
We certainly hope they will. This country is based on the fantasy that the government is the voice of the people. Going through the motions of voting and keeping the kingmakers dealing secret is central to our culture.
Why do we need electronic voting machines in the first place? They're just not as reliable as our cloaked masters, no matter how good the software gets.
Well, I understand people's concerns, but from now on, we at Diebold will see to it that we properly safeguard the illusion of democracy for all Americans.
All right, now that was a spoof. It was a spoof. The Onion created a video about Diebold, the manufacturers of the electronic, some of the electronic voting machines, releasing the election results for November 2008, just a little bit early. Is quite a funny segment. We're going to talk in just a minute with Lou DeBose about the complexity of the Texas primary / caucus voting system, even before the men and women at Diebold get involved, and we'll take your calls. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Lou, if you don't know him, you should. He, for many years, has worked as the editor of the Texas Observer and was the co-author with Molly Ivins of many New York Times bestsellers, among them Shrub, The Short and Happy Political Life of George W. Bush, not short enough, and Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. Lou, give it your best shot. I do not understand how the Texas system works. Enlighten me.
Nobody understands.
Oh, maybe that's the point.
That's the big secret. No, it's not that bad. And we, you know, we do this because, you know, Diebold can't cheat us of our vote if we stand up in a caucus and elect one third of the delegates. Two thirds are selected. You know, you have two thirds of the delegates, not excluding the super delegates, but two thirds of the vote delegates who are up for election will be elected at the polls.
Mm-hmm.
And we trust that our electronic voting machines will count. That evening, the hardy souls who and party activists who stick it out go to a precinct convention. As soon as the polls close, there's a precinct convention. And at the precinct convention, there are another third of the delegates chosen at the convention.
Now, give us the thinking behind that. I mean, obviously, primaries, everybody gets to participate in the privacy of their own voting booth. It's a one vote, one person election across the state. The caucus is a face-to-face operation where you have to go at a certain time and obey certain rules, and it's typically lent itself to, both, some people would say manipulation, others would say mobilization on the part of the party elders and party activists. What do you think of these two systems now that you get to enjoy both?
You know, no one has paid any attention to this since McGovern was running, to be honest, since Carter ran.
I mean, taking us back there again.
Because, I mean, here we are in a state in which the Democratic Party has really been dead for a long time. And, I mean, I think it works on behalf of campaigns that put, you know, boots on the ground, organized active campaigns. In this case, we have 600, as I said, more than 500,000 people, 640,000 people have voted in the primaries. And 20% of those in the Democratic primary have never voted in a regular general election based on their early analysis, and half of these people have never voted in the past three Democratic Party primaries. So there are a lot of people who are brand new to this process. I think it's going to work in favor of the party that does the best organizing. And I've been to a couple of events on both sides where they're trying to teach people, you know, how to teach their organize their volunteers how to go out and teach people how to take over a precinct caucus, and the first person in many cases, there's no one who's a precinct chair because the precinct chairs have long quit showing up. So it's the first person who comes in and grabs the packet that chairs the precinct caucus. So I think in the end, Obama wins because they have flooded the state with volunteers.
So what is that? If you were to assess it with respect to democracy, is it a democratic system? What do you call it?
No, it's not. It's 2/3 of the voting is conducted under the the honest light of the Texas sun, and a third of it would be done in smoke filled rooms were it not for the smoking ban in Austin.
and I guess if you're controlling those, if somebody you like is controlling those not so smoke filled rooms, it's fine with you, and if not, it sort of stinks.
It has let the most organized candidate win.
Well, that should indicate ability then to be effective during the general. But I've seen much argument over the last few months with people saying it actually doesn't indicate that at all.
Yeah, and in Texas, the real worry is that they love us at the moment. But will the campaign come back once the delegates are awarded in the primary process? Will the candidate that's chosen come back? Hillary has pretty much said she won't. She said it's not in the Democratic Party's calculation, angering a lot of people in Texas about Texas specifically. The Obama campaign says that they intend to have Texas in play because they feel like he can turn out voters that have not been to the polls.
Good luck. Let's take a call. We've got Espinola calling in from Texas. Where are you calling us from?
Well, I'm a native Texan. I'm in L.A. to sell property. I found this interesting. FedEx had the county register's office in Tarrant County to FedEx me my request for absentee, and I FedExed it back. African American, former Marine, drill sergeant. Three members of my family will be working the Obama rally in Tarrant County, and I found this very fascinating because he was right on the money about the African American turnout. I think what people are missing here. I started out as an Edwards supporter. What we did, and it's like 50 something of us that are registered to vote in my family. And I think a lot of time the Anglo media, they're not looking at the African American political blocks. What we did in my family, I took his voting record while in Congress. My sisters took Obama's voting record while in Illinois. And we kind of emailed back and forth what was the important issues to us.
Really? Who needs the media when you've got Espinola's family?
Yeah, and so I looked at the congressional record, and that's what I made my decision on. I think Obama's supporters are, first of all, smart. And when we do, and I've been a delegate. I was a Shirley Chisholm delegate. Do you remember when Sissy Farenthal was running?
You betcha, and I know Lou does.
Yeah, and Lou, you remember that?
I certainly do. It's Sissy.
Yeah,
Sissy.
I went all
Sissy
the way
is
to
still
Austin
running.
And all the way to convention as a Shirley Chisholm delegate. I'm 60 now, and he's right. My precinct chairman is dead, been dead. So I am so excited, and I've asked my sister, actually what she did is she's registered in, and she basically moved to my grandmother's house so we could go back to that old precinct. I love Texas politics.
So wait a minute. You're going back to a dead man's precinct to take over?
Hey, it's Texas.
Hey, it sounds good to me. What a fascinating place you report on, Lou.
It is indeed.
No,
indeed. So this is not a family. This is a political committee that this caller is describing. there's a county in Texas with only 100. Loving County, I think, only has 250 residents. A family like that could go out there in a year. Own that county.
Well, this goes back to a much more macro question, which is as the media are, it's not just the candidates that are for the first time paying attention to Texas. It's the mostly D.C.-based political press corps that are paying attention to the state in this primary race in the way that they never have before. I did see one person say, Texas, which Texas? Texas is so diverse. All states are, but Texas in a kind of startling way. Is it possible for reporters to get a grasp on this place? And if not, what should we outsiders be looking at as we try to assess or anticipate what will happen? Or should we just sit back and wait for the results on primary day? What do you think, Lou?
Yeah, it's pretty tough, really. It is, Texas came in into the union under an agreement that it reserved the right to divide into four or five other states, which I think is a good idea. I mean, El Paso is a part, is essentially an extension of Ciudad Juarez, a big, huge Mexican city that dwarfs El Paso. Then if you go to Navasota, where I was just 2 days ago, you're in East Texas on the Brazos River. You are essentially in the Mississippi Delta. you know, in the panhandle, you're closer to liberal Kansas than you are to an Amarillo, than you are to far closer than you are to Corpus Christi, Texas, or even Dallas. And it really is diverse. It's very hard to run here. There are 19 media markets. You have to buy a campaign has to buy media in 19 markets. These beleaguered reporters who will be in were in San Marcos last night, were in Austin today, will be in San Antonio tomorrow. I just spoke with a couple of them. You know, it's a state like this is pretty wearying. But I do think what you look at in Texas is, I don't know what to look for in advance except for the fact that there is there's huge spending on media in Texas. Clinton has spent $3 million. Obama has spent 4.6. That might be critical. I also think what you look for is the fact that the Rio Grande Valley, that stretches along the lower Rio Grande Valley, which was a place that Democrats always went to for votes, there are more Mexican Americans living in Dallas and Houston now than there are living along the border of the Rio Grande Valley. Mm. So, I think the Hispanic population is key. I think the black population is key. I think if Hillary can't really turn on and turn out the Hispanics in high numbers, then I think you have to stick a fork in it. It's over for her.
All right,
the blacks are going to turn out.
Lou, thank you so much. Appreciate
you
taking the time with
Thanks
us.
For letting me rant.
You're welcome. Anytime. I think I learned something about the Texas system. Lou DeBose, you can find his writing at the Texas Observer and pick up his books, co-authored with Molly Ivins. There are a lot of them. They're all good, and you'll be smarter for reading them. Thanks, Lou. Check out more on this program coming up when we talk to Jonathan Steele, Guardian correspondent, about his new book, Defeat, how the U.S. and British lost Iraq before the war even began. But before that, many, 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 many more of your calls. I'm Laura Flanders sitting in for Tom Hartman. You're listening to Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
We're back. I'm Laura Flanders. In the news at this hour, Bush has just wrapped up a press conference. He's apparently concerned about surveillance gaps in the nation's infrastructure. In other news, Ralph Nader has picked a running mate, Matt Gonzalez, of the Board of Supervisors out there in San Francisco, here to bring us up to date on at least the D.C. goings-on. Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, what about that press conference?
Well, the press conference was interesting. Basically, he said that allowing the lawsuits against the telecoms would be unfair. He said if any of these companies helped us, they did so after being told by our government that their assistance was legal. Well, there was one company, Quest, that refused. And he said this is the big bone he threw out to the companies and to the frightened public. Because a litigation process could lead to the disclosure of information about how we conduct surveillance, and it would give Al-Qaeda and others a roadmap as to how to avoid the surveillance. I mean, if that is not...
What he's really concerned about, of course, is that the investigations could reveal who in the White House okayed this mass intelligence gathering, dragnet operation that the telephone companies engaged in.
And who at the telecoms played ball with the administration, and were there any campaign contributions that can later be put together, and et cetera, et cetera.
Was he given any tough questions?
I don't think he really got very many tough questions. I mean, he then went into the foreclosure issue, and he then said that the Democrats' bill was basically to bail out lenders and speculators and to help American families, which is completely not true, but that's how he decided to spin that.
Now, does he believe yet that there is any danger of recession?
Well, like the rest of the crew, and actually Bernanke did talk about it today and said that he was testifying before Congress today, and he basically gave the administration's line. he said that the economy was in no, it was not in the kind of shape, he said it was not in the kind of shape that it was in 1970, when things were, you know, a lot, in the early 70s when things were a lot rougher. And it was interesting because Christopher Dodd, who was chairman of the committee, said that the country's economic situation is very serious, if not perilous. And of course, Bernanke took very much of a different tack on that.
Now, what else is going on in D.C. today?
Okay, well, we've got some other interesting news here. One is that there was a foreign relations meeting on Pakistan today, and that was chaired by Joseph Biden. Biden, as you know, just came back from Pakistan. Mm-hmm. He said that they recommended tripling non-military aid for education and infrastructure, saying that that had a lot of bang for the buck. But then he said, or then he didn't say it, but Barbara Boxer then went after Negroponte and said that 70% of the funds that were given to Pakistan were misspent. Then she quoted Musharraf as saying that his troops are not searching for Osama bin Laden. And then she said that Negroponte had a low priority along with the administration on an independent judiciary for Pakistan, and that they say that that's so important for Iraq, but clearly they don't care about it in Pakistan.
Now, with respect to that tripling of non-military aid, obviously it stands to reason. How many of us have said, you know, if you really want to target terrorism, how about giving people from some schools that aren't run by religious extremists? Now, if we tripled our non-military assistance to Pakistan, what would you end up with, like $30?
It's still not much. I mean, when you consider that, you know, it's less than 1% of our budget is to any kind of foreign aid. It's a drop in the bucket. And I don't know the statistics now, because if you include AIDS funding, it's obviously increased. But in 2000, less than $1 billion was for the entire continent of Africa.
And then we found out that half that money never even left the country, because it ends up getting siphoned off by debt agencies here in this country. Now, with respect to that exchange between Senator Boxer and Deputy Secretary of State John Negroponte on post-election Pakistan policy, what was his response? I mean, it sounds like she was pretty tough.
Well, yeah, I mean, he basically said that he believed that, you know, he said that that there was a lot of support of the Pakistani people, that the administration would still do that, and that they're going to support Musharraf while he's still in office. I mean, it was a lot of sort of not answering directly, that's for sure.
Anything else up?
Okay, well, the only other big news, again, is that the there's a group called the Project on Government Oversight, and it's an independent, you know, 501c3 kind of thing, a non-government organization, and they attacked the inspector generals, and they said they lack subpoena power, that they can, there's, they, before they can post any one of their reports on the internet, they have to get the secretary or whoever the administrator of the agency's permission. So a lot of stuff is just deep sixth that they do, and since they don't have subpoena power and they don't have much of a budget, they're kind of there in name only.
Well, that's no surprise, although it's an important statement to make. One of the questions that's been in my mind as we look at this primary race on the Democratic side is, who is it that's best able, who's going to be best able to repeople the offices of the civil service? Because I think that the Project in Government Oversight is making a good point about the Government Accountability Office. But how many agencies of our government these days have just kind of been shoved into either irrelevance or so demoralized that nobody wants to work there anymore?
For sure, and then you have, you know, that the budgets are really not fair, and a lot of it are going, like if you look at HHS, Health and Human Services, how many of it is going to sort of faith-based or the Office
That's
of Family
right.
Planning?
Demoralization is at its highest. Who is going to dig us out from that and re-inspire people about service? Ellen, thank you so very much.
Thank you
can find
thank
out
you
more.
Thank you very much, Laura.
TalkRadioNews.com. I'm Laura Flanders. We'll be back after the break. Stay tuned.
The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Talk radio for those who don't want arrest. This is talk radio for people who are willing to do some work to live in this so-called democracy, who are willing to do some actual work and take responsibility for helping this nation approach the promises that it aspires to believe in. We're not there yet, people, but maybe we could get a little bit closer if we all pull together now. The number is 866-303-2270. No, democracy and politics ain't no spectator sport, and you hear that every day on this show. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman. He and I agree on that for sure, as do many of you. We'll get to your calls. And let me just, before we do that, tell you what's coming up. You know, not so long ago, John McCain was talking about U.S. troops being in Iraq for 100 years. It's one of the phrases that will haunt him on this campaign trail. In this hour, we'll talk to a longtime reporter from Iraq, Jonathan Steele, who's covered the area for The Guardian newspaper in the UK. He published a book called Defeat that raises this very question: how viable would a long-term U.S.-British occupation be? His simple answer, not very. We'll find out why and what, therefore, a little bit later in this hour. But first, some calls. We were talking about Texas, and Margie is on the line in Austin. Hey, Margie, welcome.
Hi, Laura. How are you? Great to hear you.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. You're tuned down your local, your radio there?
I'm not listening to the radio because you...
That's very weird. Station. I just got an echo. Anyway, you go for it. Your question.
Okay. Well, listen, it's not so much a question. I just heard a lady saying that she mobilized her whole family, and she was an Edwards supporter, now Obama.
That's right.
Well, I was also a staunch Edwards supporter, and now I'm Clinton. And although ideologically, I mean, I've taken the test. People have sent me tests like, how do you line up ideologically? I line up with Obama. The reason I'm supporting Clinton, and I've mobilized my family to do the same, is because, you know, I'm Latino and I have a large family. And Hillary addresses the problems of my family better.
Well, tell us how. I mean, first, the most critical question is, I think it was Espanola who called, said there were 50 members of her family. How many people in your family, Margie?
Well,
maybe you
I
could
think
both
there's
stay
about
home.
20, but I'm. It's not just my family; it's my neighbors.
Oh, I'm
and my
teasing.
Friends.
I'm teasing. I was just thinking maybe you could both stay home.
Yeah,
and
no.
You canceled each other out. Tell me why. No, seriously.
Actually, we are a large Catholic family. You know how that gets. But
seriously, what are the issues that you think make the difference? You know, are the tipping points for you?
Well, all of us. I have 7 siblings, and you know, some of us do better. Some of us work hard, but just aren't doing as well. But all of us have jobs. Some of us have jobs. Some of my siblings have jobs with no health care. Some of my siblings have been laid off and in between jobs have no health care. And I'm a big fan of Paul Krugman. And he wrote an article in the New York Times on February the 4th that compared both of their health plans. And he consulted experts who said that without mandates, you're not going to get universal health care and that hers gets us closer. And, you know, we learned from the debates that they both have mandates. Hers are everybody should have it, and his are for parents. You know what? Also, as a parent, he said something that made me wonder, and I'd like the answer to this, is he said, Hillary said, well, you know, you're not going to be able to force certain people to get health care unless you have mandates. And she was referring to young people, young college-age kids. And we have that in my family, too, some of my nieces. They're not going to buy health care because they have other things on their mind. And,
or she said they believe they're immortal.
Well, that's definitely true for some of the...
It was true for me.
You can keep telling them all you want and until, you know, they're in the situation. But anyway, so he said, oh, don't worry, because they could be covered under their parents' health care plan till 25. Well, if there's parental mandates, does that mean that even if my child has graduated from college, working and not living in my house, and she shows up in the emergency room, am I going to be held accountable for their health care?
That's a very good question. Maybe somebody from the Barack Obama campaign will call in and clarify.
But, you know, so that's that, the health care thing. The other thing is I'm a parent of a child who's in sixth grade. She loved school until third grade, and they started tax testing them. That is so stressful. It is terrible. I've testified in front of the Texas legislature against the tax test. And when I, you know, Hillary has said she's going to do away with No Child Left Behind, which is an unfunded mandate. And as a result of No Child Left Behind, our kids are being tested to death. She wants to do away with it. And they both have plans for fixing the schools, but he hasn't said, as far as I can tell, our newspaper compared the Austin American Statesman compared both of them. And let me tell you that they endorsed Barack. They don't say that he's not going to support No Child Left Behind. And
he raised another question, Margie. Barack Obama, in an article that I saw recently, said that he wasn't opposed to considering public funds for private school vouchers. Where do you stand on that?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Yeah.
No, that's terrible. You know what? We can't take money out of the public schools. We need to work with our public schools.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see it. These are two topics where I feel like it's fine. Yes, there are differences between the candidates, but really, neither one of them is getting at the kind of change, the only kind of change that I think is going to make a big difference. The reason I have a problem with mandated universal, I have a problem with mandated universal, although obviously we want universal coverage, is that essentially it's a mandate to require people to sign up to pay the sort of for-profit premiums that the health insurers have gotten used to, instead of challenging the whole notion that we should have for-profit health care. We shouldn't. We should have not-for-profit health care, single-payer, universal coverage. That's where I would like this debate to be. And the same with education.
I agree with you, Laura. It's cheap and easy. I'm right there with you.
For us to say get rid of No Child Left Behind, but we have to get much bigger. We need to talk about national education financing so that you don't have public schools dependent on the tax base of that particular county or district. That's the kind of conversation we need to be having, and it takes me back to where I began this program. I feel like we're going to end up having disputes over the small stuff because nobody's really talking about the big stuff. But I appreciate your pitch and your explanation of why you're rooting for Hillary Clinton. How many of your family have already voted?
I was going to call him today and see how many have already voted. I think about 10 of them have. Well,
yeah.
10. Mm-hmm. About 10 of them have, and my neighbors as well, and I'm organizing them to go to the precinct caucus with me. So,
well, good for you.
And we're going to make a party out of it.
What will you do after this primary? That's my big question. All these people who are getting involved in the primary, are you going to stick with your involvement in some form or another?
Well, I have. I had been active way back under Jimmy Carter, and then, you know, I was a very young person then, and then got involved in all the things I was doing, and I hadn't been involved until George Bush motivated me to get involved again.
Another one for George W. Bush. Thanks so much, Marty. I appreciate the call. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more of your calls, and in a little bit we'll hook up with Jonathan Steele. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Don't go away.
Is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Here we are, we're back. I'm Laura Flanders. You're listening to Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Let's go to a bunch of your calls. There's been a lot on the on our table today, on our virtual radio community conversation table. We've chewed on the strange and interesting primary/caucus process of the state of Texas. We've chewed on the trade policies of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. We've talked, at least I've talked, about what it would mean to have yet another campaign where we don't really talk about the tough stuff, the real stuff, but instead fight out our future on the turf of the details, on the turf of our prejudices, race, gender, trust, you name it. Are we going to have another race on stuff that doesn't really change our lives, just stirs us up to sit in warring camps? We've talked about that, and we've talked a little bit about what is the future of our electoral process itself. In the next part of the program, we're going to talk a bit about Iraq, too. This is clearly going to be a conversation for this election. I'd like to see it be a central topic of debate. What's the future in Iraq? How are we going to get out of the situation there? Jonathan Steele, Guardian reporter, will be with us in just a bit. But first, your calls. Let's go to a few in succession. Sharon in Seattle. Hey, Sharon, welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm really a Nader voter, kind of an idealist, but I do have a thought about Obama, and I think that because of his charisma and his ability to communicate, that we have a real chance, kind of a chance in a lifetime, to possibly push an agenda through, because he can go over the media and also the over the heads of the Blue Dog Dems and the Republican senators and the right-wing radio with his ability to communicate, and in conjunction with a lot of the activists that are rejecting Bush, the issue groups like Move On and Air America, and dragging the Democratic Party along with some independents and Republicans, that we might be able to help him push the one or two issues through, like ending the Iraq occupation and universal health insurance. And it seems like Edwards might be foreshadowing this idea in his Iraq recession campaign that he's gathering with Move On and the Union.
Yeah, that was the news. That was part of the news this week, that John Edwards and his wife Elizabeth had signed on to a new Iraq 2008 campaign, along with Move On and a lot of other organizations. What I saw hopeful in that was this 527 group, which will be able to take out, you know, spend money on advertising, issue-based advertising during the general election, is going to be focusing on Iraq in this session, because frankly, it's only pressure from outside that has pushed the two Democratic contenders to be even as good as they are, which is still a little wishy-washy in my view. And this is the time where we have to keep pushing. You're absolutely right. Will Obama help? I think only because he leaves the door ajar. By virtue of his style of organizing, his history as an organizer, and the pitch that he's made to his followers that they are going to be part of something if they vote for him, then I think the door is ajar, and we can push it further open. Thanks so much. I appreciate the call, Sharon. Jake in Eureka's been waiting for a long time. Hi, Jake.
Hey, Laura, how's it going?
Oh, it's going well.
You know, I think a part of the reason that America really wants change is the quagmire in Iraq. And Hillary Clinton and her vote for the war, and like you said earlier in the show, her going to the Senate floor and suggesting that there was a link between Iraq and 9/11 and Al-Qaeda, you know, people are done with that sort of politics. That's what we got from Bush and Cheney. And even though Hillary has switched her position supposedly on the war now, people just simply don't find her credible on that issue.
There's a lot of people that say, look, she was senator from New York and the fires were still burning. And what did you expect her to say?
Well, obviously, politically, she made a miscalculation by thinking that she had to vote for that war. In fact, it's that vote for the war that's going to sink her candidacy.
I suspected it. I think you're probably right, Jake. Thanks for the call. John in Portland. Hey, John.
Hey, Laura.
Glad to have you. What's up?
I think that both of these Democratic frontrunners are completely missing the boat on NAFTA. I mean, worse than you did on that ship in Florida.
You mean they're not even scrambling up the rope ladder?
They're drowning in the water. And Tim Russert threw them a great big pitch, and neither one of them hit it out of the park. They're not explaining to the people how enforcing labor standards and environmental standards in the countries that are benefiting from NAFTA are going to do a thing for the American working class.
Well, Tim Russert put it very forthrightly to Hillary Clinton. He said, in 6 months, you know, there is a clause that enables you to withdraw from this pact. In 6 months, will you do it? Neither one would say they would.
She insinuated that she might, but even if wages in Peru or China or Mexico are tripled, they will still be a fraction of what a United States union wage is. So it seems to me that either prices are going to increase or corporate profits are going to decrease. And we all know how the corporatocracy likes decreasing profits.
Yeah, I think it's going to be prices going up at Walmart. Thanks, John. Appreciate the call. John in Westlake Village, California. Hey, John.
Hi, how you doing, Laura?
I'm doing okay.
Great show. A couple quick things. One, you know, McCain with his statement about Iraq and also the possibility of other wars, and also this general yesterday talking about manpower problems.
Whoever becomes
the nominee, if they don't bring up the issue of the draft coming back with a guy like McCain, they're crazy. I mean, that's such an obvious thing. That's what these people are telling us.
Do you think John McCain really would push it? I mean, he would be in a position to, in the sense that he's, you know, I think one of two, or is it three? I think two members of this Congress that have, or at least members of the Senate that have any kind of family member involved in this war. He could push it, do you think?
I think the manpower needs are calling for it. If he's true to what he's saying, that's basically what they're saying, in my opinion.
Well, you know what their plan is.
At least raise the issue and put them on the defensive.
You know what, I think you're absolutely right, John, in terms of strategy for the Democrats. And in terms of reality, you know what's going to happen is they're going to fill that manpower and womanpower shortage by using private contractors.
But that's not enough. I mean, given, you know, if you find more than one, it's inadequate now. I mean, your guest is going to... I mean, I've read the book, and it's true that it probably wouldn't work anyway, but that doesn't necessarily keep us out of there. And so that just means, you know, the doctrine's going to be we needed more troops on the ground in the beginning, you know, as a reaction to Rumsfeld. So,
Would you ever support the introduction of the draft, John?
I'm sorry?
Would you ever support the introduction of the draft? I mean, there are progressive arguments
for it. Not
those
kind of wars. The draft are for true wars of national defense, and those wars are not.
All right. Thanks for the call.
You know,
we got to go. Thanks for that. We'll come back with our guest, Jonathan Steele, after the break, and then I'll give you a hint, at least, of what we're going to have on the program tomorrow. More fun to be had before the week is done. And I'm not on board ship. Laura Flanders sitting in for Tom Hartman. Stay tuned.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
We're back. You're listening to Tom Hartman's Program on Air America Radio. I'm Laura Flanders. And we're going to talk now with a very special guest, Jonathan Steele, longtime reporter for the British Guardian, published a book last year, Defeat, that's just now available in the U.S. Defeat, Why America and Britain Lost Iraq. It's an important account of how we got into this mess. More significantly, I think, at this point, is it talks about what it will take for us to get out. How does any of the reality that Jonathan Steele knows from the ground relate to anything that's being said by the candidates in the U.S. presidential race? Well, that's what we're about to find out. Jonathan, welcome to the program. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start first with this sort of off-the-cuff comment that John McCain is going to regret he ever uttered, that U.S. troops could stay in Iraq for another 100 years. There are all sorts of political reasons why he regrets it. Just on the purely practical, strategic front, is it conceivable that U.S. troops could stay in an indefinite way in Iraq?
I can't see it, and I can't understand why he would make such a stupid mistake. I mean, the U.S. forces just aren't strong enough to stay there for another 100 years, and I think the U.S. public is not going to tolerate it. So I think on all accounts, both in terms of the reality of the military and in terms of domestic politics, it's an extraordinary comment to make.
Now, when you say aren't strong enough, what do you mean?
Well, I think there is resistance in Iraq to what the Americans are doing. There's a national resistance, both on the Sunni side and the Shia side, and I think it's growing. As the more the occupation stays there, the less chance there seems to be of it leaving. No date given for withdrawal. People get more and more angry. I mean, the opinion polls of Iraqis show that a majority of Iraqis want the Americans to get out. And it's true that the number of attacks on Americans has reduced. I think that's because just for the moment, Al-Qaeda is now seen as the greater evil. The Americans are the lesser evil. They don't like what was, in a sense, a kind of second invasion of Iraq, which happened from about late 2004, 2005 onwards, when these Al-Qaeda jihadis came in and started provoking a civil war. But the Sunnis have turned against that, and that's why in Anbar province now there is relative calm, and in parts of western Baghdad as well, because people are turning against Al-Qaeda. But it's only a temporary thing. I think once Al-Qaeda is reduced, and these people may turn back on the people who were initially the greater evil, and that was the American occupation.
Well, the other big component that U.S. audiences hear very little about when it comes to the supposed impact of the U.S. surge of troops is the Muqtada al-Sadr Mahdi Army ceasefire. That was supposed to be 6 months long. I understand it's been extended, but boy, it's hard to get a sense of the lay of the land when one side has put down its troops, or at least its weapons, and said it's not going to fight.
Well, that's right. I think it's really important that the Muqtada al-Sadr people have now extended that for another 6 months. Of course, he doesn't control all the people who claim to be operating under his umbrella. And so there are some of these people who are mini warlords, really, in some of these Shia suburbs and districts who don't really listen to what he's saying, even though they claim to pay allegiance to it. But they have actually also reduced their attacks. And so that's another reason. But I think the third reason why the surge seems to have worked, what one should say is why the civilian casualties have gone down in Baghdad and elsewhere, not just because of the surge. That third reason is that, putting it very brutally and bluntly, it's harder to kill people now. Why is that so? Because the mixed neighborhoods of Baghdad have now all split. There's a kind of sectarian apartheid has developed. I mean, if you were a Shia living in a majority Sunni area, you've got out by now if you haven't already been killed, and you've fled to another part of Baghdad or another part of Iraq or even out of the country. Similarly, if you're a Sunni in a majority Shia area, you've gone too. And so this apartheid has developed, and it's much harder, therefore, if somebody wants to go out on a killing spree for sectarian reasons, to actually find the victims, because it's much more risky.
So the silence that we're hearing, insofar as we're hearing silence, is the silence of, sort of ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, it's been ethnic cleansing, partly forced and partly voluntary. I mean, it makes sense for people to flee. I mean, they don't want to, but if the risk is that if death is, if they stay there, then of course they're going to flee. So it's a kind of displacement, really. And, 2 million Iraqis have left the country, and about another 1.5 million are displaced within Iraq.
Mm. We're talking with our guest, Jonathan Steele, who spent a lot of time in Iraq over the last 6.5 years. He has been reporting for the British Guardian for much of that time. He is the senior foreign correspondent for that British newspaper. Let me ask you about the debate in this country, the televised presidential contenders debate this last Tuesday, turned at one point on the question of what you would do if, what each of the candidates would do if the Iraqi government asked U.S. forces to stay. It seemed to me that a more interesting question might be what would the U.S. president do if the Iraqi people asked the U.S. forces to leave, as they consistently do in polls. But what do you make of that question, and is it the right question to be asking Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think it's a mischievous question, because it's obviously trying to imply that Iraqis want them to stay, and wouldn't it be odd if Obama sort of went against the wishes of the Iraqis, or Senator Clinton did, by saying, no, we've got to have a timetable for a pullout. I think it's mischievous, because it's not based on reality, as you said in your question. The majority of Iraqis don't want them to stay. They want them to go. And if the Iraqi government were to say that, then I think it would just show how isolated it is. I mean, it is isolated. We know already, they're almost as isolated in the amber zone next to the green zone in Baghdad as the U.S. officials are. So I don't think they any more are really in touch with a lot of the people who initially voted for them.
Mm. The book that you've written, Defeat, talks very broadly and powerfully about the U.S. and the British alliance, and talks about both forces' experience in Iraq. I'd like you to share some of the conclusions in the book and some of your own thinking over the years, reporting from Iraq but other places too. What have the British learnt? It's not always been such a united kingdom. What have the British learnt about military occupations that perhaps we, the Americans in the 21st century, perhaps we're the power, the empire, the country of empire, what have the British learnt that we would do well to learn ourselves, do you think?
Well, I think there are two things that are the classics in British colonial history. One is that there's a little bit of divide and rule to try and keep the other side disunited, to prevent them mounting opposition or resistance. The second thing is to say, you know, who are the strong men? You know, we better work with the strong men and not oppose them. And so it means there's, I think, sometimes less ideology about a British colonial experience. It's more a question of we want to find surrogate rulers, puppet rulers, people who will work with us, and we don't. We're not coming to bring them democracy. We're not coming to bring them freedom. We're basically in their country for our own interests, and we'll work with the power structure that's there and try and prevent it opposing us. So I think it's quite pragmatic, quite cynical, if you like. And I think that's pretty much how the British military operated in Basra, even though Tony Blair was obviously a great ideologue and a moralist and thought he was sort of bringing freedom and democracy to the Iraqis. I think the British military, who were faced with a real job on the ground, were much more cautious. And in fact, they really put the Islamists, the Shia Islamists, in power in Basra even before the 2005 elections. I remember being there before the elections, and all the people who were the kind of people who the Americans would have liked to see in charge in the country, you know, the sort of liberal, secular, professional people, the doctors, the engineers, the architects, English-speaking, British-educated, many of them, they were really disappointed. They were saying, why have you, you know, your people imposed an Islamist governor on Basra? They really felt betrayed somehow. But I think the British military thought, well, it's much better to have an Islamist in charge because he's more likely to control the situation than somebody who's in a minority like the secular ones were.
And let's remember that the very first political act that the Americans took in Iraq was to squash expectations of an early election at a time when the secular forces would have had a chance, perhaps, to have their voices heard. What else, in terms of lessons learned, are there in with respect to withdrawal? I mean, the British have had to leave ignominiously and less ignominiously from different places. We are in the conversation now in this country about how to get troops out of Iraq. At least we have two candidates that say they want to do that on the Democratic side. If it's crazy to say we'll stay for 100 years, is it equally crazy to say we'll get out in 10 months? And what would that take, do you think, Jonathan Steele?
Well, I think the other sort of lesson to be learned from the British colonial experience is that ultimately you do have to get out, and you have to get out after talking to the people you've been shooting at and who've been shooting at you. I mean, you've got it. It's quite unsavory, and you can call it ignominious at one level because one minute you're fighting people, and then next you're sitting at the table and accepting them as the future new rulers of the country that you're leaving. On the other hand, it may be ignominious at one level. Another level, it's common sense and practical and intelligent to realize, you know, which way the cards are facing. So I think in the case of the U.S. and what they should do now and how they should withdraw from Iraq, I think they have to negotiate with these people, initially on a ceasefire, and secondly, that the phases of the withdrawal, how it's going to happen, and make sure that there are no attacks as they walk out. And I think it's very good that General Petraeus and his people have accepted the Muqtada al-Sadr ceasefire in a quite a respectful way. I remember in the early months when he first became known, you know, they talked very rudely and disparagingly about him, you know, saying he's a guy, he's a thug, he's a young upstart, he's a bully, he's a fascist, a Bolshevik. You know, they used all the sort of cliches from the Cold War and earlier. And now they are calling him Sayyid Muqtada, which means, you know, it's the most respected title you can give to any Muslim. So I think they realize that he is a key player, and you've got to talk with him and work with him eventually, and hopefully they'll do the same with some of the Sunni the leadership on the other side.
We're talking with Jonathan Steele, who's the senior foreign correspondent for The Guardian and a regular broadcaster on the BBC and CNN. He has a lot of books out, most recently Defeat, Why America and Britain Lost Iraq. Before we let you go, Jonathan, one last question, which has to do with how you elsewhere, in London, I believe is where we're talking to you, are looking or watching the presidential debates in this country. This Tuesday, again, to go back to the debate in Ohio, I was struck that the debaters and the moderators spent no fewer than 7 minutes discussing the distance between Barack Obama and Louis Farrakhan, which is very broad distance, and 4 minutes talking about Iraq, an issue that for most Americans is pretty up close, personal, and urgent. What are you making of that elsewhere? Does this seem absurd to you as it does to me?
Well, it is very odd, and I watched the other debate a week earlier in Austin, Texas, when it was pretty much the same thing. I think they had about 4 minutes on Iraq then. But I think it's people here feel that in some ways it's a good thing that Senator McCain looks like being the Republican nominee, because then Iraq surely will be back on high priority as an issue, because that's one of the major differences between him and both Clinton and even more so Obama. So I think Iraq will come back into the picture. But there is this other argument that the economy is also linked to Iraq, and that you can't say these are two separate things, the economy and Iraq. They are linked. I mean, the American economy is partly in a bad way because of so much spending and borrowing money to spend on this Iraq war and the huge amount of money that's gone into it. So I think the two issues should be linked.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm with you. Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. Good luck with the book. Defeat is the name. It's out now from Counterpoint Press. We will take a couple of your calls before we go to the end of the program. I thank you all for listening. Jonathan, good luck. We'll be back in just a bit. I'm Laura Flanders. This is the Tom Hartmann Show.
Tom Hartmann Program, where smart people get their news.
The Tom Hartmann Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
Brought to you in part by them and in part today by me, Laura Flanders. You can find out more about me, my work, my book, Blue Grits, the radio show I do for Air America Radio Nation, which is heard weekends, at my website, lauraflanders.com. Who the heck is she? Go find out, lauraflanders.com. Tomorrow we're going to be continuing our conversation about the international picture. I mean, 7 minutes on Farrakhan, 4 on Iraq, that just doesn't do it for me. I think that was the sort of gotcha journalism of Russert and Williams just gone haywire. How much lower over this limbo bar can you go backwards, you two candidates? Down to your knees? Down to your ankles? Just how much further can you abase yourself on this question of how much distance lies between you and the anti-Semite Farrakhan? That was just silly. What we need is serious talk about the crisis facing us in Iraq. Serious discussion about what we're learning about the reality of the situation in Afghanistan. And while we're talking about all that over there, don't forget what is happening right here. We're going to talk tomorrow to the editor of Mother Jones magazine, one of the editors, Clara Jeffrey, who is responsible for a big package getting the cover of the magazine this month on the war coming home. Torture hits home. Do we really expect that we can send a generation of men and women into these untenable conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other parts and expect us not to pay a price back home? Well, the first people paying a price are the people in the families of those deployed, deployed for longer than they were ever trained to be deployed, deployed for with less equipment, fewer resources, in a more chaotic situation than they ever anticipated. There is a price. We're paying it right here. Torture hits home will be one of our topics tomorrow. We'll also get an update on the situation in Afghanistan from Joshua Holland, who's been writing very strong reporting for alternate.org. He's a senior writer there. And we'll hear from Patrick Coburn, who has a new book coming out about Muqtada al-Sadr, whom we just discussed with Jonathan Steele, and has a lot to say about the reality in Iraq that is skipping beneath the headlines of our news. All right, the longest person waiting online at this moment is Daryl in Marysville. Daryl, you're going to have a minute to make your point. Go for it.
Not a problem, Laura. Fantastic listening to you. Hey, everybody's dumping on Hillary about her war vote, but people have this real short memory. Do you remember the political atmosphere back then?
Yeah, I do.
You know, Brock was against the war, which is great, but he was not in a Senate seat. He was
The vast majority of people all around the world were against the war.
Yes, everybody was. But he never got the intelligence. She got intelligence that was spoon-fed to her. Okay?
She also got an NIE report that she didn't read in full.
Yeah. Yeah, she's already said that she was lied to. But
there's being lied to, and then there is choosing to take the spoon-fed version, the summary, because you don't want to take the time to read the whole, I think it was only 180 pages.
Yeah. Yeah. But you have to remember, you know, how much pressure was put on people to vote for the war. You know, you weren't patriotic, you know, and you were a traitor if you didn't. So that's kind of so people should kind of back off a little bit on that one.
Well, you know, the reason it has the resonance that it does, and I completely get you. I wouldn't have wanted to be her in that moment, but you know, she opposed the international treaty to ban landmines. She voted against an amendment that would have restricted exports of cluster bombs. There's a record here that is problematic. It wasn't one vote. We'll talk about it more tomorrow. We'll have more debate, more free speech. Someone's paying for it, but not us. I'm Laura Flanders. You're listening to Air America Radio. It's been fun sitting in for Tom. I'll be back same time, same place tomorrow with Josh Holland, Clara Jeffrey, and Patrick Coburn. Don't go away. Have a good evening. Get busy, get smart, and stay curious. And have a little fun while you're out there.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.